Our final speaker this morning is an expert on the weather, and we are indeed indebted to him because he told me that we had an ironclad guarantee of a great day today, and he's correct. He is currently director for the Center of Climatic and Environmental Assessment, which is located in Columbia, Missouri. He has graduate training in meteorology, a master's degree in agricultural economics, and a doctor's degree in atmospheric science. He is presently a consultant to the World Meteorological Society, and is concerned with the economic impact of weather and climate. I'm sure he's going to have a very important address for us this morning, and it's my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. James McQuigg.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very pleased to be here. We lived in Minneapolis a couple of years back in the early 50s, and I don't recognize anything. You've changed this whole town. You sometimes have the feeling that you wonder why you're in a particular place. You've put me in kind of a hard place following three excellent speakers, with the additional difficulty that if I talk too long, you're all going to miss lunch. So I'll try to keep my remarks within my time bounds. There's always been an interest in weather ever since man started growing crops. The early recorded writings that we have, the writings in the Bible, the folklore, the culture of most places is heavily loaded with references to droughts and floods and famines and good times, the seven lean years and the seven fat years that Joseph interpreted for the king of Egypt. The interest in the effect of weather on crops, I think, has reached a more intense and a much more broader level in recent years. We are now finding people interested for the first time in the impact of weather on crops in parts of the world that they never were concerned about before. The famous Russian wheat deal of 1972 was brought on partially by a really rotten winter in their winter wheat area, where they had severe cold with no snow cover on the ground, and the winter wheat was severely damaged, and the spring was so cold and late that they didn't have time to put in a second try at spring wheat. And this brought on the need for the grain that the Russians bought. There are two overriding facts. There's all kinds of rhetoric, and you can read all kinds of stories in the press, in the newspapers and magazines about the controversy in the meteorological community about whether we're undergoing climate change or not. And this is an argument that will go on for some time. But there are two facts that I think are very clear that we can use as the basis for our thinking on the impact of global weather patterns on crop production. One fact is that for various reasons, we had been seeing a drop in the reserves of grain worldwide for some time prior to the 1972 drop. If you plot out the figures that USDA publishes in their Foreign Agriculture Service series, the thing they call beginning stocks, which is the best estimate of the amount of grain on hand as of the 1st of July each year, they publish these, and they publish production figures. So if you know reserve stocks 1 year, the beginning of July, and you know how much you produce worldwide, and you know what your stocks were the next 1st of July, you can do like you do when you balance your checkbook, and you say, well, we consumed so much. As a percentage of annual consumption, back in the early 60s, the beginning stocks were something like 30 to 35%. There was a gradual decline in this until about 1966, 67, when we drew down reserves to send the massive amounts of grain that we did send to India following some monsoon failures. There were some weather failures elsewhere in the world that weren't so heavily publicized that year. But if you plot this trend in reserves as a graph with time on the horizontal axis and percentage of consumption on the vertical axis, there was a slow decline with a sharp dip following this monsoon failure in 66, and then a continued slow decrease followed by a very sharp decline following the 1972 season. There are various versions of how much how big these reserves are. And you can find several different authors and several different groups quoting different figures. But the central theme of all of these figures is consistent, I believe, in that even the most optimistic assessment of reserves puts the magnitude of the amount of grain that we have in reserve at or near 10%, give or take a few percentage points. The significance of this to a man like myself, who's primarily interested in the climate and the weather patterns, is the following. And I don't believe this following point is very well understood either. The difference worldwide in production between a really great weather year and a really rotten one is about 10%. If you want some examples of this, or if you got some kids that are studying this in school and you want to give them some homework reading, get hold of the Foreign Agriculture Service publications for 1972 and 1973. 1973 worldwide food grain production estimate was about 980 million metric tons. 1972, which was a rotten weather year, production was a little over 900, the difference being about 90 million metric tons, or pretty close to 10%. This fact underlies all of the discussions that we might have regarding a food conference in Rome or consumer discussions or however. And the fact is that for some time to come, the size of the reserves that we have worldwide will be largely influenced by what kind of global weather patterns we have. This is the one input into the whole problem that we really can't hold a committee meeting about and decide this is how it's going to be. We aren't that much further advanced beyond early agriculturalists who were, we think, completely at the mercy of the weather. We're not that far away from being largely influenced by climatic patterns as we think we are. The other fact that underlies our discussion of the impact of climate on food and how this affects our policy, how this affects what we do as individual businessmen or farmers or as corporation officials, is the following. In many areas of the world, including the Corn Belt of the U.S., including most of India, the Sahel, including the Western Prairie provinces of Canada, and including a great part of our Western grain producing area, the High Plains area of this country, we had a run of favorable weather that went on for about a decade or two, depending on which area you're talking about. This run of favorable weather coincided with most of the recent technological and scientific developments that we call technology. This was the time when the things that we did in India as part of our technical assistance, our AID programs and our others, this is the time when most everything we did, the introduction of new varieties of seed, the Green Revolution, the introduction of new machinery, and introduction of chemical fertilizers and insecticides in economies that hadn't used these before. The weather cooperated during this decade or two, and everything we did came out like gangbusters. And most everybody, I think, forgot, almost completely forgot, the fact that climate is not fixed. It is not a number that was written down on a stone tablet and brought down off the mountain to be used forever. We forgot that climate changes, and a whole lot of our policies and the programs that we had were based on the implicit assumption that the climate was going to forever be this happy decade or two of crapshooter's luck that we had with marvelously favorable weather patterns. Now, it's easy to get up before a group and say that. You already introduced me as an expert, you see. I can show you hard numbers. We make a lot of fun of weathermen. If I didn't have a thin skin, I would have got in some easy job like running General Mills. The fact is that you can make all the fun you want of the weatherman, but we have data This is the one thing that a lot of people dealing with policy questions can't fall back on. We don't have 100 years of records of modern agriculture. Most corporations don't have 100 years of consistent records of how they operated. Things have changed. The whole mix of governmental and industry and agricultural policy and procedures has changed drastically. But in most parts of the world, we've got at least 100 years of very, very good records about the climate. The Indian people don't like a lot of the things the British did when they had India as a colony, but one of the things the British did do was to put in a first-class weather service. And on a magnetic tape in my office, I've got more than 100 years of records from India. And if you take a look at monsoon failures and come up with some index that you could agree on, and the index that we chose was if a year got less than 50% of normal rainfall, we called that a monsoon failure. Maybe 50% isn't the right value, but you'd sure agree that if you had less than half your normal rainfall here in Minnesota, you probably wouldn't be too happy. And if you do this kind of statistic over a 100-year period, you find that early in this century and toward the latter part of the preceding century and on into the 1920s, the likelihood of monsoon failure was something like about 1 year in 4, 1 year in 5. And then for some reason that I can't explain, there was a period of about 2 or 3 decades starting in the late 1920s and running on into the late 1950s and the middle 1960s, when the likelihood of monsoon failure in India was down like about 1 year in 20. The rainfall came just like it should. Everybody said, oh, it must be the 10th day of June. It started to rain. And they got about what they needed. Some variations, but pretty favorable. Now, a whole lot of what happened in India was implicitly based on the fact that this regular monsoon, the good rainfall, was going to continue. Less than 6 or 7 years ago, the Indian government came up with a 5-year plan that said, we're going to become self-sufficient in food. And you all know that about 3 out of the last 5 years, the monsoons have failed in India. This last year was one of the worst they've had. There were places in India that didn't get even half what they should have had. And they were counting on the winter monsoons in some parts of the country to make up their third crop, and these rains are failing. The projection of climate that was used in the 5-year plan for India implicitly assumed that the climate was going to stay like it had been. The same thing happened in the Sahel. I recently took part in an MIT study for the Sahel. Do you know that there were 2,500 studies prior to the one we did? Most of which were financed by our country and France and Sweden and Germany, some by Russia. Most of these studies ignored the climatic factor altogether and just said, well, if we can get the right kind of government policy and if we can get the right financing and if we can import the right number of engineers and scientists and show these people how to do a modern agriculture, they'll be just fine. And a whole lot of those Central African countries projected their national budgets on the basis that they would be exporters of food. And then the droughts came. We're now in the beginning of the 8th year of drought in that area. And if you go back and look over the historical records, again, the French did a lot of bad things there, but they set up an excellent weather service. And on this same magnetic tape, I've got about 100 years of records out of Central Africa. And there are historical accounts and other kinds of evidence, like tree ring evidence, that show that these prolonged droughts come along quite often. And the 10 or 15, maybe 20 years of good rainfall that followed World War II, during which the technology of that area was beefed up, also resulted in increased population of animals and people, was based on a perception of climate that was completely unrealistic, that could not be sustained. And we call it a tragedy when the rains quit coming. The tragedy was we didn't see it. We didn't use our information and our knowledge of climate to say, this is what the climate really is. It's a variable thing. Up till 1974, the perception of climate regarding production of grain here in this Midwest wasn't too much different from what we had for India and Africa. If you look at the grain production figures for the Corn Belt of the U.S., and I highly suggest that you take a serious look at these data, if you plot these out on a graph from 1900 on to present time, you find that back in the days when your great-grandfather and grandfather and maybe your fathers were farming here in this Midwest, corn yields varied along maybe 25 to 40 bushels per acre, lower during the poor years, nearer 40, 45, maybe even 50 in the good years. And then along about World War II, when we started putting in hybrid seed varieties and started pouring on fertilizer and better machinery and smart young guys like the man we heard earlier in the program were farming, the trend toward increasing yields went up every year. And if you plot these out, the variability around this upward trend was very, very small. And I think we convinced ourselves that we had built the all-weather farming system. I've been hearing about the all-weather airplane since I've been in the weather business, and we haven't built one yet. And we haven't built an all-weather production system either, but we almost convinced ourselves that we had, because the economists and agronomists and others were saying, what do you mean, Jim McQuigg, we ought to take weather and climate into account? Look at how little variability there is in our grain production. And when we came out with a drought study in the fall of 1973, it was ridiculed and was ignored. And then we had the drought of 1974. And I was asked to do a study on probability of freezes about the middle of last summer, and we had the freeze. I was asked to give a speech early last year about this time to a horticulture society. And as I went into the room, one peach grower from Missouri was saying, I wonder what this clown's going to tell us. He said, we got froze out last year. I hope he's got some good news this year. And I told the group, the climate is changing. It's getting colder in the northern hemisphere. And we froze them out the second year in a row, and they haven't invited me back this year. We've got two fundamental problems that are of a technical and scientific nature, in addition to the political and economic problems and the moral and ethical problems that the other speakers are going to talk about. The two basic problems have to do with the following. We call the increase in yields that we get from applications of technical and scientific and better management tools, we call this the increase due to technology. It's shown up worldwide, better some places than others, some places hardly at all, but the projections of future production of grain, by and large, have been based on somebody fitting an eyeball line to the trend of recent times and just projecting this on into the future. This projection, again, is based on experience that came out of a very happy, favorable run of climate. And I think most of the projections of future productions are overestimates, are overly optimistic. We have used the figure 3 to 4% over. And if I were redrawing the trend line for FAO, if I were redrawing the trend line in yields for our own USDA, I would take whatever this projection was and I'd shave it off a bit, and I'd say it isn't this steep, it's a little less. 3 to 4% is a significant amount of difference when you're talking about grain reserves that are somewhere near 10%. And if we are going to be able to produce the food that we need, we had better not overestimate our capabilities, but have a very realistic assessment. If the prices that the previous speaker talked about as target prices are based on an overestimate of yields, the target prices will be too low. There's very serious implications of how we estimate this. Back when we had 25 and 35% reserves hanging around that people called surpluses, an error of 3 or 4% didn't make a darn bit of difference. But 3 or 4% out of 10 is something we'd better not ignore. How about the future climate? The climate of the coming decade or two will most likely not be as favorable as the last decade or two, and this will not only be true for our own area, but will be true worldwide. The period that we call normal is probably the most abnormal period of weather worldwide that we've got in our recorded history. I wish, as meteorologists, we'd quit using this dumb word, normal. We are able to make some sort of a projection of future climate on the following basis. If you do have long-term records that go back 100 or so years, the thing to do in assessing your prospects for the future decade or two is to not use the most recent two or three decades, but go back and find the records from late in the last century and the first two or three decades in this century. And if I were one of you, or if I were president of General Mills, or if I were on some policy board in a corporation, I'd want somebody to do this for me, or I'd want to take a few evenings and sort this out for myself. You want to see what kind of climate you're going to have the next decade or so? I can't tell you exactly. I'm not that much of a fool. But if I were trying to improve my odds, and if I were trying to be completely realistic about my prospects, I'd go back and see during the latter part of last century and the first part of this, how many years like 1974 we had, how many of these occurred back to back, how many times did we have a very early freeze following a wet spring, how many times did the crop get delayed so that it was starting to form grain during the time of the summer when we know we're going to be dry, which is late July and August. I'd want to take a look at this. If you can't find these records, raise the devil with your Extension Service people. Go to your university people. Write to my friend Joe Strube out here at the airport and tell him Jim McQuigg said that he'd help you find these records. And I'd sit down on some of these cold winter nights when you're not attending meetings, and I'd study the heck out of these, just like you read all of the other material that comes to you. And I'd be concerned about the future climate. The little unit that we've formed in Columbia is part of a three-agency effort, the NOAA group that I work for, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the NASA group that have launched the Earth's satellite, and the USDA have formed a three-agency cooperative project to use the Earth's satellite to estimate acreages of crops globally. And my group in Columbia are building the weather crop yield models, where we'll take the flow of weather information that we get globally and follow each crop year. We're right now following the developing 1975 crop globally, and we will make assessments of the yield prospects as the year progresses, and the combined information from the satellite and from our unit will funnel through the usual mechanism for releasing the kind of information USDA releases from time to time about our prospects for production and worldwide prospects. I believe that combining our talents and combining our facilities, we can sharpen up the estimates that we make and avoid some of the very serious errors that we have made in just assuming the trend is going to continue uninterrupted with favorable climate. Thank you very much. I'm 1 minute over.